WBR, Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons, and I'm Sue Bartholomew. And on the Commons today with us, we have Peyton Knight. Peyton is the director of Environmental and Regulatory Affairs for the National Center for Public Policy Research. Peyton, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Sue. It's my pleasure.
I met Peyton some time ago, a couple of years ago, in Reno when we were both at the Freedom 21 conference, and I'm really happy to have him on the air, joining me on the air today. Today we're going to talk about smart growth. It's something that we're hearing a whole lot about, Peyton. Is smart growth really smart, and what is smart growth? Why don't we start with that?
Well, very simply, smart growth can be defined as no growth, because what is that, in order to know exactly what it is, oftentimes the Oregon model, the state of Oregon, back in 1973, more or less spawned the smart growth movement. And what it is government planners take a look at their area and they decide how much growth they are going to need to accommodate in any certain period of time, whether it's over the next decade or two decades. Then, after they determine how much land they're going to need to accommodate future growth, they simply draw a circle or a boundary around that area, and they say, okay, we're going to concentrate all our development in this growth area inside the circle, and then any growth outside that circle, we're going to discourage or pass laws to prohibit. Now, what obviously happens is, in the areas where they prohibit growth, property values go way up. Eventually, you outgrow the smart growth area. People need to find a place to live, so they end up moving way, way, way outside the circle. Smart growth has actually spawned this, what's termed the exurb movement. You know, we used to have the suburbs, which were immediately outside the city.
Right.
Now you've got people in high-density urban areas who are commuting from way, way outside the suburbs, clogging highways, you know, increasing demand for roads, et cetera, because of the growth limits on places that are closer in, just outside the city boundaries. So it causes a lot of problems. It causes a lot of traffic congestion. It causes housing prices to become vastly unaffordable for medium-income folks. As it's become more and more of a proven problem and failure in a lot of areas, people are starting to rebel against it.
Is there a rebellion against it? Do people understand this? Because one of the problems, Peyton, is the smart growth movement has come up with all these pretty words. I mean, there's smart growth, there's pedestrian friendly, there's walkable. There's a million of them. New urbanism.
Sure, traffic calming.
Oh, God, yeah, that's another one, isn't that?
That's a popular one, too. No, you have to hand it to the other side. They definitely... It's deceptive, so you can't hand them that because a lot of their terminology is incredibly deceptive. However, it's attractive terminology, even if it is deceptive. Like you say, smart growth, other terms like sustainable development, who could be against anything?
Well,
and
I know.
Sustainable, and yet still allows us to continue to develop. I mean, yeah, these terms are all deceptive, but yes, they are attractive. There is a backlash against the movement because as people continue to lose their rights, continue to find areas more and more unaffordable, more and more congested, they say, hey, wait a minute, this is a smart growth area and this is what we're experiencing. So clearly, you know, these policies aren't what they're cracked up to be. I mentioned Oregon earlier.
Yeah.
Oregon being the birthplace, more or less, of the modern smart growth movement. Back in the early 70s, and you know they passed a ballot measure a couple of years ago. Oregon's a very blue state, votes Democrat by and large, and they passed a ballot measure doing away with or severely scaling back their original smart growth model, which is incredible. And we should talk more in depth about that because it is incredible. But you see examples of like Oregon cropping up. Washington State, I know there are movements within Washington State to do away with smart growth laws. And eventually these backlashes happen. People become more informed. They see the results of the policies and how the policies hurt them. And yes, they move in the opposite direction.
But I mean, it's sort of a fad right now. It's not an easy fad to fix. In the promo I talked about, you know, you have food fads, and that's okay because, you know, that's got a shelf life. It's not going to last forever.
Mm-hmm.
You've got clothing. That's okay, too. But when you come in and you bulldoze an entire area and you rebuild it and you find out that smart growth really is stupid growth, and that it not only has not fixed the problems we were told they were going to fix, but it's created even more problems.
That's right.
You can't go in and just bulldoze it down again and start from scratch.
No, you can't. You can loosen up. You can change your policy, and loosen restrictions that you've placed on property owners in the area from developing, and let the market respond to whatever local people's housing needs are, their traffic needs, et cetera. But that's really the best way to go about it. That change takes a long period of time. You can't just come in and bulldoze and make it all better again. But the change can happen. Oregon was a fantastic example. I mean, what you had in Oregon was extraordinarily strict smart growth laws that took away people's property rights. They couldn't develop. And they eventually got about a measure on the ballot called Measure 37 that simply says if government takes away somebody's property rights in the name of open space preservation or smart growth or anything else, they have to pay the property owner for the lost value of their property that results from those restrictions.
Oh, really?
So it basically just said, hey, you can still regulate people to death if you want to, but you got to pay for it. You can't steal. You just got to pay for it. It's like saying, I can walk up to you, Shu, and take the watch off your wrist, but I got to pay you for it. And you may not want to sell me the watch, but, you know, so the point is, it didn't even roll back all the policies. It just said you can still run ahead with these policies, these smart growth policies, but when you take away people's property rights and therefore devalue their property, you have to pay them for it.
So
every newspaper in Oregon editorialized against this ballot measure. The Sierra Club, you know, big multi-million-dollar environmental groups all put enormous amounts of staff and money into a campaign to defeat that ballot measure, and it still passed almost 2-1.
Wow.
And it's very simple. I mean, all odds against it, but it was a great glimmer of hope that people, you know, you can't fool people all the time. These are people who have lived with smart growth policies for 3 decades and have seen the detrimental impacts that they have. No amount of slick advertising, radio spots, newspaper editorials, you know, glossy ad campaigns, no amount of it was going to change their mind. They knew the truth. And they turned out in droves to pass Measure 37 and effectively put a real stake through the heart of Oregon's smart growth policy.
So basically they treated it as a takings.
Exactly. They treated it as a takings. Anytime you make government pay for what it does to a property owner or any citizen, you're going to slow down the detrimental effect of government's regulation. If government has to pay, they have to budget for it. What's that?
I said they just raise taxes.
Well, that's the downside. Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. But it still makes it more difficult because raising taxes is not terribly popular.
But so they're also raising money through sleight of hand. There's a tremendous amount of that stuff going on. People don't believe that they're paying all these taxes, but they're being double, triple, and quadruple taxed.
Well, that's true. That you're absolutely right. But it that is a problem. But it still slows it down. They do have to budget for it, or they have to run up a deficit, or they have to do something like take more tax money. All things which most people consider negative. So it does work. When you make government pay, by the way, it's constitutional, too. And that's what the Fifth Amendment says. If you take somebody's property, you have to pay them for it. So it does help. And Measure 37, I mean, again, a blue state. This is Oregon. This isn't, a red state. It's a blue state. So, and still, people turned out 2-1 to vote for Measure 37 to do away or to severely curtail Oregon's smart growth revolution. And the other piece of good news was, of course, opponents said, well, this isn't constitutional, this ballot measure. Yeah, it passed 2-1, but it's not constitutional. The Oregon Supreme Court, in which rather surprisingly, actually, upheld the ballot measure.
Oh, really?
Yes. So there are glimmers of hope out there. And like I said, I know Washington State is another state that's been grappling with trying to do a Measure 37 type reform. And I know that I think other states as well are starting to look at the Measure 37 model and say, how can we do this in our state? This is extremely successful. But it's a wonderful thing.
You said that, did you want to go into a little bit more of what they were doing? I seem to remember reading about Portland, where they had all these rings around there, and you could do this within this ring and this within the other ring, and so on. And I have to tell you that I got a lot of calls and emails from people in Portland, and of course the focus of the show and the focus of what I do is predominantly homeowner associations. Of course, everything within smart growth ends up within a homeowners association. So, there was also other fallout that probably was not really defined in the newspapers.
Yeah, it's congestion in localized areas was a problem. Just the simple fact that people who got caught up in the no-growth boundaries lost tremendous amounts of money because they no longer could productively use their property in order to accommodate, growing areas. So it was those things. In terms of real specific examples, I don't have any off the top of my head. But the general concept was what Oregon planners would do is they would try and look into the future, 10, 20 years, and determine how much additional infrastructure, housing, et cetera, they would need in an urban growth area and draw a ring around it and say, okay, we're going to concentrate all our growth in here, and outside this circle up to such and such number of miles for a boundary or whatever, we're not going to allow any more growth, essentially. And, it's not just poor planning because central planners typically can't, it's not one size fits all. It's a quasi-socialist mode of operation. There's the fact that people may not want to live in an urban area. Having a quarter, half acre, 5 acre, 20 acres,
right,
and a house somewhere, your own little, kingdom. And you're not going to be able to expunge that from people's, hearts and desires simply by saying, well, we're going to build houses here, so you're going to have to move here. People will find a way to get what they want, even if it means driving 2 hours outside an urban area and commuting.
We're talking to Peyton Knight. He's the Director of Environmental and Regulatory Affairs for the National Center for Public Policy Research based in Washington, D.C. I just wanted to take a minute. We're getting a lot of calls that are coming in, so you're resonating. You're either upsetting someone or you're resonating with someone, and they're dying to have something to say. Unfortunately, we only have the one phone line, so we cannot take calls during the show. But if you'd like to send me an email, I'll make sure that Peyton gets a hold of it. You can send it to onthecommons@cox.net. That's onthecommons@cox.net, and I will make sure that Peyton gets it, unless you'd like to provide an email address, Peyton, because I know the phone's just been ringing like crazy here.
Okay. Do you want me to give my email?
If you'd like to, yeah.
Sure. It's P. Knight. It's P-K-N-I-G-H-T at nationalcenter.org. And okay. You can check us out on the web at nationalcenter.org.
Okay. Thank you. It's always nice to know. I'm not sure whether they're thinking, hey, wait a minute, I really like this, or whether they're thinking, yeah, you're right, and I'm dying to find out. So send us both an email, why don't you? We're seeing this. I mean, you're talking about Portland, you're talking about Washington State, and predominantly in the Northwest, but that's not the only parts of the country that we're seeing this crazy notion going on, is it?
No, you're right, and there are a number of different tools at Smart Growth's disposal to accomplish what they want to accomplish. I mean, it's not just having a smart growth policy and drawing a boundary around an area. I mean, you can have any number of preservationist laws and regulations that essentially accomplish the same thing as an out-and-out smart growth policy. Heritage areas is a good example.
Oh, what's that?
There are state heritage areas and there are national heritage areas, and they all vary in terms of what their specific vision or regulatory structure is. But essentially what they are preservation zones. They're boundaried areas. There are currently 37 national heritage areas. They're boundaried areas where a special interest group, usually a preservation group or a conglomerate of preservation groups and environmental groups, are given jurisdiction over the area. They're told by Congress to come up with a management plan that would, in effect, result in lost property rights, and land use restrictions, down zoning, et cetera, all in the name of preserving the culture or history or whatever vague concept they might have of the area. But it's really just smart growth by any other name. It essentially puts, vast areas, it makes it extraordinarily difficult for any sort of development or infrastructure improvements to take place in those areas. So there are just so many tools at their disposal, and it's not always termed smart growth explicitly, but you've got a lot of preservation tools and laws and regulations that have essentially the same effect.
The heritage areas. Now, you were talking about smart growth is something that's been around for about 30 years. We're just hearing about it, and we're sort of hearing all these pretty words that go to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
But the heritage areas, is that a relatively new thing, or is that
relatively
been around?
in the sense that it's only, let's see. It's less than two decades old. So that's relatively new. And like I said, there are 37 today, but they're coming a lot faster now. I know Congress is going to take up six or seven new national heritage areas in July and begin considering them. And you know, it's a bad thing that's proliferating across the country. I know we've got one in our neck of the woods. I don't think it extends all the way to Fairfax, but it hits Fauquier and Prince William counties. Stretches actually all the way from central Virginia up into southern Pennsylvania. It's called the Journey Through Hallowed Ground National Heritage Area.
Right.
And, you know, this is, the groups involved in this are the same ones that have consistently opposed private property rights, like the National Trust for Historic Preservation, the Piedmont Environmental Council, and a number of other groups. And what they're pushing for is this Journey Through Hallowed Ground National Heritage Area, which would, among other things, give them $1 million a year and task them with creating a management plan for the area that would restrict growth.
Wait a minute. Give who?
And only allow the types of growth that they want. I mean, these are very elitist things. People that push for these things, you know, are typically the very well-to-do, the idle rich, as many call them, who want to kind of make sure that they can keep what they consider riffraff out of their area by making it impossible and unaffordable for anybody else to move in.
It's kind of exclusionary.
And so this is how they do it. They get the power to create a management plan. They partner with the National Park Service, which is the agency that administers to the National Heritage Areas Program. And they partner with the Park Service to create a management plan for the area that restricts growth, all in the name of, you know, preservation and history and culture and all these abstract, touchy-feely things that don't really have much substance. And then they take their management plan once it's been completed and once the federal government approves of it. They take their management plan, they get $1 million a year, and they go to local governments and say, look, here's our management plan. Here's what we came up with. We need you to pass the necessary laws that take away people's property rights so that we can have, you know, the preservation that we want in this area. And if you help us, we'll be able to give you some of this federal money that we've been getting. So it's kind of a, you know, it's really federal zoning is what it is once you connect the dots between where the money's coming from in the federal government and making its way down to the local level, you know, and spurring these zoning changes.
Now,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, it's really federal zoning kind of through the back door, but it's also empowering groups with a history of hostility toward property rights to have enormous influence over personal property rights in the area.
Peyton, this land presumably was owned by someone. It's not all government land, right?
That's right. No, that's right. That's exactly right.
And so what happens? Is it being taken by eminent domain, or are they
not well, the group themselves, the interest groups who serve as the management and for the heritage area don't have eminent domain power. But local governments in the area, a lot of them do have eminent domain power, obviously. So if the local groups were to say, look, so-and-so's farm, you know, such-and-such battle occurred on so-and-so's farm, and we really think it's important that government acquire that property, they would set those wheels in motion by simply going to the government and saying, hey, look, in our management plan, we've identified, you know, Farmer Joe's land is being historically significant, and we think that you all ought to acquire it. And then the government would do whatever it had to do to acquire the property, whether that's, you know, threatening eminent domain. They could do that. They could actually take away Farmer Joe's property rights or the right to till his land based on some sort of environmental law and just kind of basically slowly push him off his property as it becomes more and more useless to him. I mean, there's any number of things that can do, but it all originates with these heritage area management plans that call for preservation. And, again, it's very touchy-feely. I mean, as you say, you know, somebody owns this land. when you're preserving land in the name of history, and land that's so-called historically significant, I mean, where do you draw the line? I mean, you can make an argument for every square inch of property in America being historically significant in some way to someone. It's very abstract, and it allows these groups broad discretion in how they set about preserving land.
Peyton, we talked a little bit earlier about, we didn't talk about it, we mentioned the Freedom 21 conference in Reno. At that conference, there was a couple of directors a couple of movie makers who were working on a documentary. And they had been interviewing, they showed us that 10-minute clip, do you remember?
I vaguely remember that.
I know you were working the conference, so you were probably in and out quite a bit.
I think that they were,
Serena?
If I remember correctly, these were folks who were looking to document victims of the Endangered Species Act who lost their property rights. Is that correct?
There were victims of people who had lost their property rights, and I think they showed the 10-minute clip.
Okay.
I remember there wasn't a dry eye in the house. That entire room, you know, everybody was kind of sniffling and wiping their eyes because it was a very powerful documentary. It was a very powerful clip.
I may not have been at that conference. Maybe it was a different conference. I'm not sure.
No, you were there, but I know that you were working and you were probably out because...
Yeah, it's what I'm thinking of. It might have been specifically geared towards property owners who had lost their farms, their ranches, their
dreams. Right, right.
Because of endangered species regulations, which is another huge problem. The fact of the matter is these victims are out there. In fact, one of the things we do at the National Center for Public Policy Research is we publish a book called Shattered Dreams, 100 Stories of Government Abuse. And in this book are numerous victims of regulations that hurt property rights. Are you familiar with the book, Shu?
No, I'm not, but I'm writing it down. I'm going to get it.
It's really a wonderful tool for people who, oftentimes, this is what the other side does so well. When they're pushing for their socialist issues, they put faces and evoke emotion from people and say, you know, how can you possibly say that this poor, you know, welfare mother shouldn't get government assistance for the rest of her life? Look at her, she's got three kids, you know, et cetera. They evoke emotion and play on people's natural inclination to want to help. You know, the fellow man.
Right.
Well, there are a lot of victims of regulatory abuse out there that evoke the same emotion. You've got people, you've got farmers and ranchers, you know, families who lose jobs, lose their business, lose
right.
their livelihood because environmental groups and the government come in and say, you know, you can no longer graze cattle here. You can no longer... sow these fields. You can no longer, you know, do anything on your property because we consider it critical habitat for this endangered mouse, or this endangered frog, or this endangered owl. You know, and this is extraordinarily devastating to people. It essentially it's wrenching. And there are people out there. There are stories out there. It's important that people read about them, learn their names, see their faces, and understand that until these regulatory policies change that put species and environmental protections that aren't even really that helpful to the environment ahead of real human lives, you know, we're going to continue to have these sort of victims out there. So
that's why going back to that documentary, those were real people and those were the faces. And unfortunately, it seems the people who had been filmed and who had been interviewed for the documentary withdrew their permission, from what I understand, because they were afraid of retaliatory measures against them.
That's a big problem, and I can speak to that as well. I know that when we're fighting a lot of these issues, like national heritage areas or, you know, endangered species issues, and you talk to people who you know have been victimized by these regulations. They've either lost significant portions of their business, lost the right to do something on their own property, or lost, in the worst case, lost their livelihood. They are hesitant because they know if they have been so beaten into submission that they just want to move on with their lives. And it's very hard to get them, some of them, to come forward because they do. They fear retaliation either by federal regulators, or they fear that environmental groups are going to start hounding them and badgering them. I mean, it's really tragic, and you can't blame them in a way. It's understandable that people want to get on with their lives, but it's a very ruthless opposition we're up against.
We're talking to Peyton Knight, who's the director of Environmental and Regulatory Affairs for the National Center for Public Policy Research, based in Washington, D.C. WEBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and on the Commons with us today we have Peyton Knight. Peyton is the Director of Environmental and Regulatory Affairs for the National Center for Public Policy Research, which is based in Washington, D.C. And you guys have been doing a lot of research on what, predominantly property rights types of issues, Peyton?
A lot of environmental and regulatory issues. Property rights issues are a big deal. We do a lot of work on the Endangered Species Act and endangered species policy, and also energy issues as well, which is obviously a very big issue right now with Congress looking to put forward an energy bill here in the coming weeks after they get back from their break next week. So.
You want to give us a website and an email address in case anyone wants to call?
Sure. The website is nationalcenter.org.
Okay.
And my email is pknight@nationalcenter.org.
During the break, Peyton and I were talking off the air, and the phone, the other line kept ringing and ringing, and unfortunately I still was not able to take your call. But so there is a lot of interest on, you know, about the topic, obviously, and I'd love to, again, please either contact Peyton or contact me on the Commons at cox.net. You can listen to the show again on my website on thecommons.us. You know, it'll be up by this evening. So check it out, and please, you know, let us know what you think. We'd really love to hear from you. What else is going on? How else are we in danger? Is our property in danger? Our property rights? What's happening there, Peyton?
Well, our property rights are unfortunately always in danger, because as long as there are government regulators who think they know better about what you should do with your property than you do, they're going to try and foist laws, restrictions, and regulations on you to get you to behave in a certain manner. And, of course, they're aided and abetted by many, many, many multi-million-dollar organizations who also see some sort of abstract virtue in not building anything, anywhere, anytime. So, you know, it's a constant battle. It's not going to go away, unfortunately, like just about every other political battle out there.
So what can we do about it? I mean, all right, so, we've got something, they want it, and obviously being scared and allowing ourselves to be intimidated is not the answer. What can we do, Peyton, to put a stop to this?
It's not trivial. You need to stay in touch with your local legislators and your national legislators. You know, write letters, emails, make phone calls, stay educated about what the threats to your property rights are, and let people, let your legislators know that you're aware of them. You know, a lot of people don't understand. They think it's just that their email, letter, or phone call is going to get lost in some sort of, you know, sea of correspondence that never really gets taken note of, and that's not true. Depending on, you know, how big your area is, or congressmen, when they receive a letter or a phone call on a particular issue, they kind of make either some of them make solid calculations, some of them just make mental calculations that say, okay, for every one person who calls in, who has the, you know, is so worked up about the issue to either write me or call me about it, for every one of those people, I'll assume that there are, you know, 20, 30, 100, 500, 1,000, again, it depends on your particular area, who also agree with that person. And that's how they make their calculations and then decide whether or not to pursue a policy that may or may not upset a large number of their constituency. So it does matter. And yes, it is difficult because most people out there, most freedom-loving people out there are out trying to earn a dollar and take care of their families. They don't have time to also do the job of the people they elected to look out for their rights. But unfortunately, it is something that we do have to do.
And what about this threat? I mean, why do people feel victimized and like they're going to be retaliated against? Because if something has happened to them, if they have lost their property rights, if they have been abused by the government or by their neighbors or by anybody that's been empowered by the government, how can we assure them that their voice is probably most important in getting the word out? How can we protect them?
I think that most people do, and they are eager to tell their stories. It depends on the circumstance. You know, the folks who are generally probably more afraid to come forward are business people. For instance, if you have a mine or something like that, you have to clear a number of environmental and regulatory hurdles every day just to stay in business. And so, you know, if you step out and start saying, hey, you know, such and such law is unfair to me and it's really hurting my business and it's going to, you know, force me to have to lay people off and I'm fed up and I'm not going to take it anymore, you're more susceptible to being antagonized by bureaucrats or environmental litigators because you're a big target, because you're a business owner. But regular folks who just, you know, who have property, who have been victimized by regulatory abuse, it is easier for them to come forward because there's not so much that the other side can really do to retaliate. You know, some of the exceptions might be if you own land adjacent to National Park Service land or federal land, then technically now the government's your neighbor, and if you're railing against the government, they may, you know, these people, it's their job all day then to antagonize you and look for ways to make life miserable for you.
It's the bully factor.
That's a special case.
Yeah.
But generally, small property owners who do come forward because they've been hurt by regulations, those people don't have anything to worry about, and they should come forward. In fact, the other side really would do, or in government as well, in a lot of cases, might do everything they can to make sure that those people don't get upset, because it's a real black eye on what they're doing.
Right.
It works against them in that case. So, you know, those people have every incentive to come forward.
Are these the type of people that you guys want to hear from at the National Center, or are you not?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. We're always looking for regulatory victims to put in our publications so that we can, you know, show that there are real human faces that are associated with misguided government policies.
So what else do we, what, how can people recognize, let's say they're not necessarily into reading all of this stuff, they're not policy wonks, they're not, you know, they're not, in, don't have the time to go through all of the papers and do the research on the internet
sure.
and all that. What things can happen, typically can they see in their own neighborhoods and recognize as clues as to what's happening? Anything that's out there that you can think of?
Well, chances are, if they want to do just about anything on their property, they'll run into some sort of regulatory setback. You know, you can't. There aren't many places in the country where you can, for example, decide to build a shed or a deck or pour a concrete slab for a, you know, a tool shed or something like that on your property without having to pay for permitting process, you know, have it cleared, maybe even receive a special exemption from your homeowners association, have to, you know, have to actually require a majority vote of your from your neighbors. So now your neighbors are basically letting you know if it's okay to do something on your property.
Oh, that's happening. That's pretty routine nowadays, isn't it?
Oh, it is. So, you know, when you look at, when you say you look, what signs people look for, chances are, if you live in a house or a home long enough, you're going to run into them whether you like it or not. And that, and it's obviously you'll know them when you do. And then use the opportunity to educate yourself. You know, say, hey, wait a minute, what? You know, why do my neighbors get to have the final say over whether or not I put a shed in my backyard? Or, you know, why, what, you know, what's, why is the government telling me that I can't put a porch on the front of my house because I'm 6 inches over some imaginary boundary line that they've established? You know, it's just, you know, just any number of things. And, you know, just ask yourself when those things happen, who owns this property? Do I, or am I just paying rent? Is this really the government's property? So chances are everyone who owns private property at some point will run into one of these signs that, you know, they're really losing their rights.
You don't live in Fairfax County, but I do. And when you, and, but you probably drive through it going back and forth to work. One of the things that we notice around Fairfax and Arlington, and of course now there's a lot of talk about doing it in Annandale, and for those of you who are not in the Washington metro area, these are suburbs of Washington, D.C. in Northern Virginia. They're doing all this, what they call revitalization and redeveloping and turning all of these you know, all of these old neighborhoods into walkable communities with traffic calming measures and private police. There was an article in the Washington Post recently about Silver Spring. The downtown is now privately owned. They have security guards. You're not allowed to take photos. Is this all part and parcel, Peyton? You want to tell us a little bit about that, or... Is it part
of the revitalization, the quote-unquote revitalization effort?
Right. Is that part of smart growth?
Sure. Absolutely. You know, it, again, smart growth policies, you can call them any number of things. They come in a number of different forms. The goal, the goals are essentially the same, but the names change. You know, traffic calming, revitalization, smart growth, national heritage areas, open space preservation, you know, all these wonderful sounding things that really amount to headaches for the people who have to live in the area. But yeah, you know, when you live in an area like Northern Virginia and Washington, D.C., and you see how just extraordinarily expensive real estate is in the suburbs and now the exurbs, and you see just how, you know, more and more people driving longer hours in on more congested roads, you know, adding tons more, you know, car emission pollution to the air than they would if they weren't in traffic, incidentally.
That's a good point, you know. That's an excellent point.
Yeah, it's cars that sit in traffic all day add, you know, tons more pollution to the air than cars that are actually allowed to cruise at 50, 60 miles an hour. So, you know, you see all these problems. Just remember one thing. The central planners are the ones who set all this up. So if you really want to trust central planning and the smart growthers to determine where growth is needed and where they don't want it and how they're going to create an efficient infrastructure so that everything, you know, works in harmony, just look at the results. They're miserable. You can't trust central planning. They're the ones who gave us all this congestion. So it's, the smart growth measures come in a lot of different forms. That's just the important thing to remember. It's a tough battle because the other side is very well funded. It's always easier. It's always easier when you're lobbying for more government than when you're lobbying for less.
That's a good point.
That's another challenge.
That's a really good point.
The psychology of legislators and regulators is always, I've got to be seen as doing something, so I've got to be seen as either passing more laws, more restrictions, and enforcing more laws and more restrictions. And then that way people will see that I'm doing my job. And that's a tough thing that we're up against. So, but, you know, then there are the shining examples like Oregon and Measure 37, where in the face of extraordinary opposition and seemingly insurmountable odds, the truth won out. People had three decades was enough.
But at what cost? I mean, that whole area has been, you can't tear it down and rebuild it.
No, you can't, but it'll be a slow transformation. And that's good. That's the best you can do. It's not instant, but, you know, it puts the clamps on things. And, it's an example. I think that there are a little over 100 cities with official, quote-unquote, smart growth.
Oh, really? 100?
Urban boundary designs in the U.S. And like I said, that doesn't mean that smart growth isn't happening in more areas. It's just we're talking about official, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. smart growth. But, you know, a lot of these places are experiencing a lot of the same problems.
Now, Arlington is in our neck of the woods over here, and Arlington's a small county outside of Washington, D.C., and one of the other pretty words, basically, that goes along with all of this is transit-based development, and that's where they take the core, where you have the public transportation core, and they just really overdevelop it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that in Arlington. They took the metro stations and they developed all of that. Well, I was talking to someone, you know, in Arlington the other day who told me that now the plan is to do that to the entire county. And they're going to, you know, redevelop the entire county. Arlington's an old county. It's got all these little typical, or it had all these little typical Arlington colonials and the little
brick ramparts. Sure, it's a beautiful area.
And they're just transforming it into this high-density, walkable, pedestrian-friendly, calmed traffic, transit-based, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a mess.
It is a mess. You know, in terms of public transportation, it doesn't take as many cars off the roads as the central planners would like to think it does. And typically when they focus more money on rail, they're often disappointed in terms of what the results are and how it doesn't really have an impact on traffic. doesn't mean that people just flock to the trains. I mean, public transportation is an inconvenient thing. You know, people's lifestyles are so hectic and diverse now that they have to have the ability to be anywhere at any certain time haphazardly throughout the day. And telling somebody that they've got to, you know, rely on the unreliable public transit system is just not workable for a lot of people.
Peyton, now, they always talk about commuters. They always talk about, well, we've got to have public transportation so that the people can commute back and forth to work. Do you have the actual percentage of how many of these cars are actually commuters and how many of them are going to the doctor, taking the kids to the dentist, ballet lessons, football games, and all of that?
I don't, but I can point listeners in a good direction. Wendell Cox, who is an expert on transit issues, has written extensively about it. We probably have those statistics if folks wanted to Google his name. Again, his name is Wendell Cox, W-E-N-D-E-L-L, and then last name Cox, C-O-X, and just put in transportation or smart growth with that or something like that. And he, I'm sure he's probably got just a wealth of statistics.
Because I'd heard something like only 20 or 30% of the traffic on the roads is caused by actual commuters going back and forth to work. The rest of it is people who are going to be on the roads anyway, regardless of whether you have public transport or not.
That's right. That's right. No, that's absolutely true. I mean, all you have to do is look at the areas and look at the congestion and how it grows. I personally live in the exurbs. I commute to D.C. every day. I live in Warrenton, Virginia, which is about 50 miles west of Washington, D.C., where I work. Now, if I were to leave my house at 6 o'clock in the morning on any given day, I would get to work at about 8:15, 8:30. That's how bad traffic is. So oftentimes I do take a public transportation train into the heart of D.C., but that train is... it's unreliable. I take it because even though it's unreliable, it's, traffic is reliably bad. And even if the train is late, I can still sit there and read a paper while I do it,
mm-hmm.
while I'm being inconvenienced. not as many people do ride the train as you would think. And it certainly hasn't cured congestion in the area at all.
No, it hasn't. Peyton, believe it or not, we're out of time. It's gone really quickly. Thank you so much for joining us and for giving us all this information. I really appreciate it.
Well, it was my pleasure. It was an honor to be on your program.
And I hope you'll come back sometime and tell us what you guys are up to.
Certainly. Of course I will.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sue.
On the Commons was produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. See you all next week.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect. All my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs. Life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos. Someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice 4HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet. The writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.